Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a world that is being transformed by emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. And we take an unusual view of that transformation, a view that you're not likely to hear a lot of other places. We believe that the world is being transformed for the better, and in fact that the world is getting better all the time. And we believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're just not paying attention. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and returning triumphantly to the to the cyber studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen. Welcome back to the program.
I would like to publicly apologize for leaving you high and dry last week, Phil, but I heard it was awesome anyway.
Do you remember that scene in Scanners where the guy's head explodes?
Were you trying to wish that on me?
No. Actually, I pulled it off. I did manage to talk for an hour, but I had my weekly audio glitch, and so we've lost part of that program. So for anyone who's been looking for that show, I will be getting it back up on next week. I have it recorded. I just want to get rid of the audio glitch and get the show back up. But hey, it turns out I learned a valuable lesson. I can talk for an hour. So
that's good.
That might come in handy sometime. Who knows?
Well, I hope that I won't force it to come in handy again anytime soon. But yeah, it's good to know that you're capable of doing that. That's good.
So tell us what happened. It sounded like there was quite the story behind your.
Well, it's not that big of a story. I have a little puppy named Daisy, and she ended up breaking a bone in her, it's front left paw. And it was bad. I mean, it's like right in the joint, and it was like flopping back and forth. And we ended up at the animal emergency room last Sunday night. So
wow.
She was walking around with a little cast on and everything, and I assume she's going to be fine. She might end up with she might have kind of a stiff leg the rest of her life. I don't know. I hope not. But she's anyway. That was the situation. So
the dog is doing better now. She's okay now. Do they have one of those satellite dishes on her head to keep her from picking up?
And she's been very good about that. She's not been biting at it or anything. I think she knows that it's not right, and she's going to leave it alone. You know, because it. Just kind of, I think it hurt her pretty bad. So,
well, she's a smart dog. She's learning as she goes. That's
apparently so. Yeah. So, anyway, I think she's going to be just fine. So.
Okay. Good. Well, what a relief. And also returning to the program is our chat host, Michael Darling. Hey, Michael.
Good evening. I don't have any, amazing animal tales to recount.
Well, yours was what we call an excused absence. So, we've already covered the reasons for.
Yeah, it was two interesting experiences last weekend, and I'm sorry I missed the show, and I have been looking for it, so I can't wait for you to get it up there, punchlines and all. But the two experiences were this. One, I'm teaching undergraduate economics, and on the Friday, which was 10 days ago, right before that show, as partly because it came up in a strange way, and partly as a, hey, we got 20 minutes left, and, might as well go down this path, I told the story of utility fog in class, and I was quite confident that of the 30 or so students that were there, less than half were going to reappear the following Friday for the next day.
Yeah, you just intimidated the crap out of them, huh?
I think it was more like, okay, that guy's a nut. And then second was the Sunday. The reason I didn't make the show, a large contingent of my wife's family was in town visiting. And for that group of cousins and family, some of them haven't seen each other in 20 years. Now, I happen to know the extended family a little bit because I grew up in the same area, but I don't really know them. And so I was just nothing but the host. And somebody said something to me about, oh, well, you're not going to be around tonight, right? Because your wife told me that you do this weekly show. And I said, oh, actually, I'm not going to do the show tonight because I'm, you know, you guys are all here. At which point, you know, pretty much everybody's like, oh, well, tell us about the show. And I was like, I'm just going to tell them about Utility Fog, you know, 2 days out of three. That's something.
Man, you've become like the Utility Fog evangelist.
It was more the Utility Fog whack job, I think, would be the way that they were describing it.
Well, when we get into that later, we'll have our guest can grade your presentation. We'll have you give a quick like 2 minute spiel on Utility Fog and see how you do with the real pro. But speaking of family, I'm glad you mentioned that you had a family get together, because we don't want to lose sight of the fact that today is Mother's Day, and so we would like to wish a very happy Mother's Day first and foremost to the Specky Wives, the Fast Forward Radio widows who are out there taking care of our children for us this evening while we're doing the program, also to our mothers. And we always extend this to all mothers, to all stepmothers, to all mothers-in-law, mother figures, maternal types, as well as motherly people and anyone who at any point has had a mother. We wish all of you a very happy Mother's Day. Did I miss anyone that time, Stephen?
I think you got everybody.
We always try to include everyone on those.
When you said anyone who's ever had a mother, I think that pretty much got every person who's ever lived. So.
Oh, well, come to think of it, yeah, that really should include just about everybody. So, okay, good. So happy Mother's Day to all. And real quick, Stephen, before we bring out our guest, I think you have been to a movie that Michael and I haven't had a chance to see yet. Tell us all about Star Trek.
I can't tell you all about Star Trek because I don't want to spoil it for any listeners we have that, you know, haven't gotten to the theater yet. But suffice to say, if you ever liked Star Trek or ever had any inclination, well, you know, this Star Trek thing, I need to check it out. This is the movie. If you know if you've never been a part of Star Trek before, jump in. If you've love Star Trek since the very beginning, you're going to love this. It's the treatment that Star Trek always deserved but never really got. It was always kind of, you know, they'd throw $30 million out and they'd make a movie. And $30 million is a lot of money to you and I, but that's not all that much money to make a major Hollywood production. This thing, I think they spent in excess of $100 million. I'm not sure, but it shows on the screen. They took their time. And if you don't already know, they recast the original characters. You got a new, brand new Spock, brand new Kirk, brand new Bones, and you got new Scotty, and Chekhov, Sulu, Uhura, and all the rest. And it's really neat to see these characters play things out again in what amounts to a reboot. We're getting to see things happen in ways, you know, nothing is set going forward from here. So it was pretty cool.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Last time I looked at Rotten Tomatoes, it was ringing in at somewhere around 97-98% fresh.
Right.
So,
everybody who sees it likes it. So, you know, which is different from the movie I saw last week, which I also liked. The Wolverine movie I kind of liked, and like, you know, 37% of the critics liked that. So anyway, you're liable to like it on any level. So, I recommend it. Get out there and watch it.
Look forward to seeing that. I had mentioned before the program that this is actually the first time that I've been in the United States, I'll say, when a Star Trek movie was released, first time in 30 years since Star Trek the Motion Picture came out, that I have not gone to see it in the first week it was out. So I'm feeling a little left out here from all the enthusiasm, but looking forward to seeing it very soon, I hope.
Well, you're just being a good dad, taking care of the brand new baby, so
yeah.
You're excused. This is an excused absence from the theater, so.
Okay, so good. So everyone's got an excused absence except for one person, I guess, really. Okay, great. Well, let's move on and bring out our guest. Returning to Fast Forward Radio is Dr. J. Storrs Hall. He is a scientist. He's an entrepreneur, a prolific writer on nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, and also on topics such as machine ethics and other social impacts of technology, and he is the president of the Foresight Institute. Josh, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, happy to be here.
Well, we wanted to start out talking just a little bit about Foresight. Now, this is a fairly new thing. When did you take the helm there?
oh, a couple of months ago. It was, let's see, some February, March this year time frame. I've been associated with Foresight since, heaven only knows when, going all the way back to their first nanotechnology conference in 1989, of which this is the 20th anniversary year. So I get my chance to do my part and help the institute along and advance its goals and its point of view. And
well, now, speaking of those goals and that point of view, very interesting change that I've observed since you arrived is that we've gone back to the original name. We were the Foresight Institute, and then we became Foresight Nanotech Institute, and now we're the Foresight Institute again. So can you give us a little background on what the evolution there was and why that particular change?
Yeah, there was an attempt on the part of a couple of the past presidents to try and make Foresight an industry group for the nanotechnology industry, sort of the way that the SME is for this mechanical engineers and that sort of thing. It didn't really work out, and there wasn't enough of a fit between what Foresight had always been and our actual strengths and the developing community of nanotechnology companies to make that work. And so it was a nice idea, but it didn't work out. And when I came on board, I had always thought that Foresight was best suited, and our real strength was as an organization of Foresight and essentially a futurist organization. We looked at what the possibilities for technology are. And just like Fast Forward Radio, we're bullish on the future. We think that the technologies have the potential to do an amazing amount of good, and that one of the things that we can do is just keep our eyes on how you go about doing that, and making sure you do get to the good benefits and avoid some of the possible pitfalls, but that the benefits are there and they are the sort of things that we can strive for and reach.
Well, I think that's a very positive change. The idea of becoming an industry group for nanotechnology, whatever the merits of that were, one of the things that just struck me as kind of a disconnect once we took on that new name, once we were the Foresight Nanotech Institute, was just that on the website and in discussion groups and when we had events, we were still talking about everything, right? I mean, we still had this interest in and focus on artificial intelligence and life extension and lots of other important related technologies. And I think it's good that we continue to have that broad focus rather than to get too narrow.
Oh, absolutely. I have been concentrating on artificial intelligence, as a matter of fact, myself for the past several years. So I come in with a point of view that AI is probably as important to the future as nanotechnology is, and they're both very powerful technologies that we are going to require a certain amount of foresight to use wisely, but which can, in the end, put us through at least the equivalent of another industrial revolution with that much of a change in the human condition.
Yeah, that's on the mild side, right? The low impact side will be something like the industrial revolution.
Well, the industrial revolution did a lot more than people sort of think now. I mean, if you understood what it was like to be a serf, which is what almost everybody was back in 1500, with a life expectancy of less than 30 years, and very rarely getting more than a mile from where you were born. And,
right.
and it's just an amazingly limited life that people had. The ability just to have trains and travel all over the country was astounding. And the fact that you can make these giant machines that you know, are more powerful than the biggest elephant, which was something that nobody would have expected to be able to see, was something that was just completely out of the realm of what anybody imagined was possible. So when I say the Industrial Revolution, I'm pointing to a period in history where something did happen, a major phase change in the way we made things and did things that was very difficult to imagine coming into it, what it was going to be like coming out of it. And so to the same extent, I mean, if you look at the absolute numbers of, you know, how many years somebody lived or something like that, extending our lifespan another, you know, average 30 years it wouldn't be a huge deal. But extending it in such a way that nobody now really believes it could happen is more the point of view from ahead of the game of what the Industrial Revolution would have looked like to people coming into it.
Absolutely. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil, Stephen, and Michael, we're talking with Josh Hall about various topics related to the future. And we have a lively chat going on in our online chat room if you'd like to join us there. Or if you'd like to leave a comment, you can leave a comment at blog.speculist.com. So, in fact, when I said that it was on the mild side, nothing, no disrespect to the Industrial Revolution in terms of what a huge set of changes it was. Just pointing out that what's coming could even be bigger than that, potentially as big as the leap from agriculture to or pre-agriculture to agriculture, or from not being civilized to civilized. A phase change of that level is, do you think possible, or is it safer maybe to draw the parameters a little closer?
But it's hard to say, because I think if you took nanotechnology and AI both, you have something that could get you into a completely different mode. I mean, right now we're creeping up on being a Kardashev level one civilization and using all the energy available to the earth. The agricultural and the industrial revolutions together brought us, you know, maybe half of the way up. The coming nanotech and AI has the capability of pushing us well beyond the level of one and getting up in the range of the level of two, where we use up all the energy from the sun, and we sort of build a Dyson sphere sort of thing. That's within the physical capabilities of the technologies that we're talking about. Now, how long it would take to actually, you know, get that done, who can predict? But that's sort of the high end of the changes I would see that you could just point it AI and nanotech together and say, okay, this is what got us to here. And that is big.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of the signposts, some of the markers on the way to that change, whatever that change might be. I want to start with a piece that you had up on the NanoDot site, the Foresight Institute blog. It would have been a month or so ago, on the topic of early retirement. And I understand that this name that you've given this concept of early retirement actually came from our friend Christine Peterson, no stranger to Fast Forward Radio herself. So tell us about early retirement for humanity. What's involved in that? What kind of change is on the horizon there?
Well, actually, that grew out of a session we had that was part of AGI 09, the Artificial General Intelligence Conference. And I had a session that was a workshop on the future of AGI after that. And I had a couple of, a number of really good speakers in, but the top two were about economics. And the key thing that we were discussing was what's going to happen to all of us humans who, you know, go to work and try to make a living when there are robots that can do anything that we can do, but more cheaply. And the there are two ways of looking at it. If you look at it from the point of the individual worker, who is, you know, the cog in the vast uncaring machine, he gets thrown out of work and you know, despair is the order of the day. But if you look at it from the point of view of humanity as a whole, what's happened is that we've built machines to do all the hard, laborious stuff that we're forced to do, and now we can just do whatever it is that we want. If, as a community of the people, we can just manage to arrange things so that the vast productivity coming out of these cheap robots can be distributed properly. And I have little doubt that there are going to be a lot of different ways that that actually happens. But both of our speakers, Robin Hanson and James Albus, sort of agreed that the key was that the people now had to essentially own capital one way or the other. You had to be in a position of being a capitalist because of the otherwise you're simply not going to be able to make a living with your labor. But the term early retirement was an attempt to define the discussion in such a way that it doesn't become it's not a horrible thing to happen to you to be thrown out of your job, because in fact what's happening is that not only you but the entire human race is retiring, to sort of help people realize that, you know, if your retirement is coming at, you know, such and such a time, then it makes sense to start saving for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we need to get ready for the retirement that's coming. So the idea is that we reach this point where essentially human labor is of, well, human beings are not sufficiently. There's no economic value in human beings trying to provide the labor to do things any longer. Virtually,
well, there's always the value. It's just that there's something else that can do it more cheaply than you can.
Yeah, no. In a competitive sense, we lose, right?
Yeah.
It's like if I wanted to pump gas for a living today, I'd have a hard time getting my career going because automation has replaced that job, right?
I'm thinking of the family farmers, or particularly those who were trying to run dairy farms around this area. And, you know, you can't get a, you know, you cannot compete against these 1,000, you know, cattle industry operations with they line up the cows and they have all these dairy machines that automatically milk and everything else. You just, as a small farm, you can't do that anymore. Not competitively, anyway.
Right, and that sort of thing has been going on for a long time. And one way of just looking at what's coming in the coming century is just to draw the trend lines. You get more and more automation able to do more and more different kinds of jobs. So if you just look at the kinds of things that automation can do, and it's fairly easy to foresee what automation will be taking over in the next 10 years simply by looking at what it can do now, but is too expensive to use robots for, like driving cars.
Right.
And right now, you know, it's a lot cheaper or cleaning houses. I mean, that sort of thing. It's a lot cheaper to have a human do either of those jobs than a robot
right.
could do today. But the abilities of the robots in the labs are such that it's pretty clear that if you really wanted to, and you threw the resources of a billion-dollar company at it, you could produce a robot that, you know, that you'd have to sell for $500,000, but that would actually be able to do that kind of thing with sort of what we know now. So you take that and you take the learning curve and you take Moore's Law and you take a bunch of other trend lines, and it's fairly easy to predict that kind of creeping up that scale of intellectually more difficult and so forth tasks that the robots will be taking over. Not all at once, but, you know, just essentially now we can do this more cheaply than a human. Now we can do this more cheaply than a human, and so forth.
So now I think I've got a bead on Aldous's approach to how we make that transition. I'll come to that in a minute. But what's Robin Hanson, what's his view on the way forward? Is it just a matter of everybody needs to hoard some capital to have some money to be able to own a piece of the action, or does he propose some way of smoothly making this transition? What's his take?
I think you had it right, the former. It's just, as an economist, he says, you know, that's how it's going to have to be. And doesn't have a particular scheme in mind. My guess is that you know, there's room for lots of schemes, and various people will be proposing different ones. And, you know, who knows how it's actually going to come out. But,
well, and in fact, the one that James Aldous proposes, his idea is the one called people's capitalism. Is that right? Am I thinking of the right person?
Right. Yeah, that's him. He's basically, he says, you know, the government needs to go out and start buying up stock and assigning it to people and so forth. My guess is that's a little optimistic. That if the government in fact does that, the people who are running these programs are not going to just go and turn over the control of all those stocks to the people. They're just going to sit there and administer them as essentially a form of welfare. But they may not even have enough foresight to start buying the stocks. They may just decide to tax the robots when they get there.
Right.
But one way or the other, that's probably one of the kind of things that's going to happen. Of course, the other thing is that people who do have foresight now can just go out and start investing wisely and so forth. And that would involve not being very heavily in the stock market last year. But you know, to the extent that you can invest wisely, it's still going to be a lot better to have done that than not to have done it.
Well, sure. You know, you're better off having money than not having money. I mean, that's a kind of brutal reality. In fact, even if this particular scenario doesn't pan out all that soon, you're better off having money than not. You know, just this would be.
Oh yeah, we're not talking about some apocalypse happening and all of a sudden everybody's out of work in 2022 or something. Like I say, it's going to be a creep. So the different kinds of jobs that people can do, can get paid for and so forth are going to change. But the other thing is that to some extent, is the robots are still not anywhere near, you know, human intelligence, but essentially just skilled machines. There's going to be probably lots of room for a person to gain in productivity simply by directing a bunch of robots. And so if one person can keep an eye on five robots who are doing what the one person used to do, then that person is in good shape and is responsible for, you know, sort of five times the productivity that they used to do. The key to all that, in an economic sense, is just finding enough things for all this amazingly productive technology to do. And that means widening our horizons and looking at more than just producing yet another variety of dippy consumer goods.
Right. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jay Storrs Hall about early retirement for humanity and a few other topics that we'll be getting into a little bit later. If you'd like to join us, we've got our live chat going on if you're listening live, or drop a comment at blog.speculus.com. Well, I had a piece on the Speculist on Friday that had echoes of early retirement. In fact, it even had the phrase early retirement in it. It was a piece of spam email that I think my brother had sent me, one of these chain emails that goes around. And the idea is a newspaper asked people to give ideas on how would you fix the economy. And this guy writes the following letter. He says, "Dear Mr. President, please find below my suggestion for fixing America's economy. Instead of giving billions of dollars to companies that will squander the money on lavish parties and unearned bonuses, use the following plan. You can call it the Patriotic Retirement Plan. There are about 40 million people over 50 in the workforce. Pay them $1 million apiece severance for early retirement with the following stipulations. 1, they have to retire. 40 million job openings. Unemployment is fixed. 2, they have to buy an American car. 40 million cars ordered. Auto industry fixed. 3, they have to either buy a house or pay off their mortgage. Housing crisis fixed. It can't get any easier than that." And then the story goes on. So this got a lot of discussion going on the Speculist. The first piece pointed out was that this plan would cost $40 trillion to implement and was a little bit outside the scope even of our most ambitious plans to do anything about the economy now. But I couldn't help but think that if we can even look at a plan like that as being within an order of magnitude or so of the kind of thing we're currently doing, how far off is it before we actually have to start thinking about truly implementing something like that? And, you know, age might be one of the ways that you would that you would start making the transition, although probably the more logical way, I would think, would be just based on role. It will happen naturally. I mean, you gave the example earlier of enabling one person to oversee, and I thought about, for example, in an airline, it could be that the only human on the crew might be the quote-unquote pilot, or maybe just the captain. The co-pilot would be a robot who's actually flying the plane, and all the flight attendants and all the rest of the crew would probably be robots too. And that would make the airline more profitable because they'd just be running machinery up there rather than having to pay all those salaries and so forth. And eventually people get comfortable enough, and even the captain would lose his job, right? So what do you think about that kind of an idea? Is there a point where we reach a kind of an economic escape velocity where productivity from automation has pushed our GDP to the point that that the government can just start handing out money to people and it doesn't wreck the economy? Or is that too rosy of a prognosis?
Well, I think that's possible, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime really super soon. One thing is that the government is already giving out sort of more than it should, and so rather than waiting for the economy to grow and then being a small burden on it, it's being a big burden and inhibiting the growth considerably. But that aside, the technological trajectory that I expect is that over the coming decade, we see machines start getting smarter and smarter at individual things enough so that in the 2020s, robotics will be seen as a huge major growth industry, beginning to make a significant impact on the economy, sort of the way the internet did in the 90s. But it won't be until the 30s when the really major substitution effects start hitting, and people realize that things are really going to be different for real. You know, if you're going to be anywhere close to retiring by, say, the mid 2030s, you don't really need to change your life plan all that much because of this. At least that's my guess.
Well, yeah. See, the 50 and up was sounding pretty good because I'll be 50 in just about 4 years, so I was kind of digging that. But
Yeah.
It sounds like we might have to wait a while before the million-dollar checks get handed out.
I'd be happy if they'd go for 55 of them.
So that, you know, that's another proposal, and it wouldn't cost as much because there are fewer people in that demographic when you think about
right.
it.
Right.
That's a more reasonable idea. Okay. All right. So that's I think something we can track is the progress towards this, and I think one of the key technologies that will drive that kind of productivity that will provide the kind of economy potentially that could get us to something like economic escape velocity would be assembler technology, nanofactory technology. And there's been kind of an exchange between you and our buddy Michael Anisimov on this subject over the past, what's it been, couple weeks, on your respective blogs related to the safety issue surrounding nano assemblers. Could you give us just a little bit of background on what we're talking about when we use that term? What is a universal assembler or a nano assembler, and what's the crux of the issue between you and Michael?
Well, actually, I think in honor of it being Mother's Day, I have to point out that what we're talking about here is self-reproducing machines.
Very good. Okay, good.
And so, as a matter of fact, in Nanofuture, the chapter on self-reproducing machines is entitled Mechanical Motherhood. So the thing about the nanofactories, whether they're self-reproducing or not, and if they are self-reproducing, it makes things a little more interesting because they're a bit harder to control the distribution of. But by and large, I'll give you a statistic that underscores this. By and large, if you build big factories that make little factories, and the little factories themselves cannot make other little factories, but just lots and lots of consumer goods, it's still fairly easy to put one on every kitchen table in the world. The statistic that I mentioned is the little project at the University of Bath called the RepRap, which is a gadget that it's supposed to be a rapid prototyper that makes copies of itself as well as other cool stuff for people. So they're actually, the project's been going on for just a few years now, and there are several thousand of those out. But almost all of them were built in a factory rather than by another RepRap, because the factories still actually are a lot faster, cheaper, and more reliable than the little tabletop RepRap is.
And does that have to do with the fact that a RepRap is intended as a prototyper, and a machine that builds prototypes is obviously, not necessarily the best machine for doing production? That those are just two different functions, and so maybe you wouldn't want to use the machine that you're using to do prototypes to do massive production of something.
No, the it's called a rapid prototype basically because it uses an additive deposition technology the way many rapid prototypers do, and it's not really so much intended to be a prototyper as actually. The key idea behind that is to have something that can reproduce itself and be used to make physical goods as well. And so the use of the word prototyper in its title is really a hangover from its ancestry.
So do we get to the point where, a la Star Trek, as Captain Picard, we'll have something sitting in the house where we can say, tea, Earl Grey, hot, and the cup of tea appears for us? Or how far down that road do you think we're likely to get? And by that I mean, would individuals have access to that kind of technology? Will only governments and large corporations have access to that kind of technology? How do you see that breaking down?
Well, you know, no less a personage than Neil Gershenfeld, the Center for Bits and Atoms guy at MIT, thinks that's going to happen in 20 years. So that's not just a foresight thing or a nanotech thing or so forth. It's well understood by the mainstream technology people who look at that kind of thing. And I agree with his assessment, by the way, in terms of 20 years from now, that's about when he'll be seeing tabletop synthesizers or general manufacturing units or nanofactories or whatever you want to call them. The key thing between Michael and me and our blogs is that Michael just has this notion that if such a thing happens, then you know all the terrorists in the world are going to go in and start manufacturing weapons of mass destruction on their little nanofactories. I think that he and a lot of the other people that come up worried about this sort of stuff fail to realize is that by the time you get one of these on your countertop, and you will, but before that happens, the governments of the world and the militaries of the world will have things that make it look pretty silly and know how to use them. A couple of years ago, I was at speaking to the up at the Naval Postgraduate School in Newport to the Chief of Naval Operations Strategic Studies Group about this kind of stuff. And we were talking about, you know, how long is it going to be before an aircraft carrier has a fabricator in it that can build a new fighter jet? And the thing is that, you know, your key Oregray hot gadget on your countertop is to what the military is going to have, the way your microwave is to a steel mill. So the fact that, you know, people can make stuff that we would consider nasty weapons now is going to be essentially just as trivial compared to what they're up against as the weapons you can make in your home shop now, which are actually a lot scarier than most people think if you actually sit down and try to do that.
So the other way of saying that is that right now a highly motivated person who wants to do harm has tremendous resources potentially at his or her disposal to do harm.
Well, right now, I mean, if you really wanted to do sort of the worst you could possibly do, you would go out and start doing, you know, genetic engineering on swine flu and you know, that sort of stuff. That's probably the fastest, easiest path to the worst of the bad capabilities. And it's still going to be the case that it's probably through biology that the worst of the nightmare scenarios is going to be achievable. I look for something like nanotech. I mean, one of the key things would be that suppose somebody did actually go and do a genetically engineered bug of some kind like that, and it started spreading, and it was really nasty. You know, you caught it and you died in 2 days, and in the meantime you gave it to everybody you knew and all that sort of stuff. If everybody had a nanofactory on their countertop, the 20, 30 years from now, when the nanotechnology actually gets to the point of being able to do that sort of stuff, one of the things that would be within its capabilities would be to analyze viruses like that much faster than we can do them today, which is a lot faster than we used to be able to do it, and come up with antigens and inoculations and so forth, and produce them. And so you would get an official letter email from the Centers for Disease Control that you would forward to your nanofactory, and it would produce a vaccine for you, and everybody in the country would be inoculated inside of 10 minutes. That's the sort of thing that, that having the nanofactory could do for you. So I think that a well-regulated system where people got to use the power of the technology for their benefit is a considerably more optimistic point of view and outlook for the world than one where that sort of thing is suppressed, because the people who are trying to do the nasty stuff are not going to be deterred by the fact that the average Joe doesn't have a nanofactory.
Exactly. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Dr. J. Storrs Hall about nanoassemblers, as well as we're going to be getting into utility fog here in just a moment. We've got a very lively chat going on in our online chat room. If you're listening live, or leave a comment at blog.speculist.com. Well,
let me jump in just real quick. Josh, I completely agree with you, and that's why I have disagreed with Bill Joy's, we've got to relinquish technology. If we don't, we're going to be in a whole lot of trouble. Number one, it's not realistic. We're not going to relinquish technology. That's not what we do. We build on what we have. But number two, I think if the good guys relinquish technology, then all you got left are people that the bad guys have technology that are trying to kill us. So I think our best solution is always just to put the pedal to the metal and keep our defenses advancing along with the offensive capability.
Yeah, I mean the thing is that the threats of the of technologies like nanotech look really horrific today, but they don't look horrific compared with the capabilities of the mainstream in the same period where, if development proceeds as normal, those kind of people would have access to it. The only time that the nightmare scenarios happen is when the mainstream does relinquish, and we're sitting here with the same technology we have today, 50
right.
years from now, and some rogue nation has developed nanotechnology, and all of a sudden North Korea is the world superpower.
Right.
Well, I want to just quickly say by way of clarification that Michael Anisimov is not suggesting that we relinquish technology. So that the Bill Joy argument is one thing, but Michael's coming at it from a slightly different angle. He doesn't want to relinquish. And let me see if I characterize this correctly, Josh. What Michael is suggesting is that before we get to the universal assembler, we need to get to the AGI so that we can have a proper authority structure, a proper control in place that would keep things from spiraling out of control and worst case scenarios from occurring. Is that how you read what his argument is?
Well, frankly, I'm not really quite sure I understand what his argument is, because what it seems to me that he's saying is nuts. And so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and assume I'm just not reading right. But what I thought he was saying was that, we need to develop this one AGI that's going to take off and be so smart that it's going to take over the world. And it will be a friendly AI, and therefore it will do everything right and we'll be all cool. I that's not the way AI works or is going to work. And B, the notion that that some project like that would actually have stand a chance of taking over the world in the face of all the other people who are developing AI and any other form of armed persuasion is vastly optimistic. A simple example: the closest thing we have to the world government right now is in fact simply the United States government, because if you've read this book called The Next 100 Years by George Friedman. He points out, you know, a bunch of basic military realities that the U.S. controls the sea lanes and most of the world economy in a way that it's only rivaled by what the British Empire did 200 years ago when it was essentially considered the world empire. The bottom real politic line is that the U.S. government really does control the world to the extent that anybody does, and arguably to an extent that you could call it the next best thing to a world government. But furthermore, it's the United States government and its military in particular, through ARPA, that has sponsored almost all the research in AI itself through up until the 21st century when there's a lot of other stuff going on. But they're still the leader, and they have more AIs and AIs doing more things and that sort of stuff than anybody else in the world. And so if anybody is actually going to develop an AI that does these superhuman kind of things, it's going to be them. And so the situation isn't going to change. So you have to look at how responsible development of nanotech capabilities and nanofactories and AI itself, which is actually going to be more powerful in many ways than mere nanotech, can be developed responsibly in a sort of an open source but reasonably well regulated way in the existing institutions where the United States government retains control, because that's just, if you try to change that, you're basically just getting yourself into a huge ball of wax that is not going to do anybody any good.
So just to clarify, because I feel like we may have skipped a step for anyone who hasn't read the relevant posts on Accelerating Future and on Nanodot, the reason that the government comes into this discussion is what Michael was originally talking about was the need for what Nick Bostrom describes as a singleton, a single point of authority that would in some way be able to protect us from these kinds of risks. Michael initially seemed to be saying that the singleton would take the form of an AGI. But per Nick Bostrom's formula, the singleton could be any number of things, including a democratic government of the world. And per your point, in the world we currently live in, the closest thing we have to that is the U.S. government.
Right. And I think that the need of a singleton is a little overblown. Basically, the reason you want a single such responsible entity as opposed to more than one is so that the more than one won't start having wars against each other with the stuff. What you really want is an essentially a cooperative community of whatever powers there are that agrees essentially that responsible development of nanotech capabilities involves the amount of control that would allow the capabilities needed for defense to be developed in by the people responsible for defense before the capabilities for great mischief got into the hands of people who might want to use it for great mischief. And I think that's, you know, something that it's not going to be very hard to get all the responsible governments of the world, including even, you know, places like developing countries so forth, to agree to. The people you have to look out for are not really the guys hiding in the caves in Afghanistan. They're not going to develop nanotechnology. It's the whole countries, places like Iran and North Korea, that actually have the capability right now to build nuclear weapons, to just switch that over and start trying to develop nanotech.
If history has taught us anything, it's that the folks hiding out in the caves in Afghanistan have figured out how to leverage box cutters into doing the amount of damage they want to do. They're not looking for necessarily ultimately high-tech solutions to problems. Now we're closing in on our scheduled time, Josh. So I wonder if we might impose on you to do an additional segment, because we don't want to lose utility fog this evening. We promised everyone that we would spend some time on that. So we can jump straight to it now, or if you can give us an additional 15 minutes tonight, we'll add a segment on the show and talk some utility fog.
Either way, I'm fine.
Okay, well let's push on here for just a moment, and then we will wrap up with utility fog here in just a minute. I'd like to check in with our chat room, Michael or Stephen, either one of you. I've been having trouble getting onto chat. So any questions for Josh or issues that have arisen that we should be talking about via chat?
No, I mean, we followed the discussion pretty well, and, you know, we haven't beamed off onto topics that need addressing, and I'm excited to talk about utility fog.
We don't want anything to get in the way. Okay, Stephen, any other questions before we turn our attention to that most important of topics?
Well, there's one thing. I'd just like to get Josh's opinion on this. I'm a big fan of Fab Labs and rapid replicators and that sort of thing. I wonder if that technology, the Fab Labs, the, you know, little factories that we have that are not nano factories, would they be rendered obsolete? Is there a possibility they could be rendered obsolete before they really arrive? I mean, I guess my question is how far down the road are true nano factories?
Well, the Fab Lab people, Gershenfeld and company, are probably the most gung-ho people in pushing that technology right towards nanofactories, as I was mentioning before.
Right.
You know, my guess is the first real nanofactory is going to be called a Fab Lab. It's just going to be, you know, Generation 52 or something. And in that connection, by the way, I'll give you guys a little scoop and mention that one of the things that Foresight is looking at doing in the coming year is essentially what I'm calling the Feynman Path Initiative, which is to take the Fab Lab type technology of the rapid prototyping machines or whatever else it takes. And design a self-replicating architecture for that, and then try and use that to build a sequence of smaller and smaller machines as described by Feynman in his famous Plenty of Room at the Bottom talk. And I think that will give people a new perspective on some of this stuff, because if you go back to the beginning, to Feynman's talk and to Engines of Creation and so forth, one of the key things in both of those approaches to nanotech was the self-replicating capability, and that's the half that got left out by the National Nanotech Initiative and all the people who are working on nanotechnology, defined as just working with the very small and molecular scale stuff. We're hoping to push back into considerations of self-replicating machines in a much bigger way than we have done in the past several years.
What's your opinion of Adrian Bauer's RepRap project, where obviously this is not nanotech, but he's trying to, in a way, create a self-replicating machine?
Yeah, he is, and it's really interesting to see this stuff, and it's actually quite inspirational. It differs from the sort of stuff that we would be trying to do in a number of significant ways, because his machine is he's essentially trying to have an economic impact, making a machine that can make stuff for people that's cheap enough that people can, you know, go in and build them for their friends and have them spread around. Whereas a Feynman approach machine would be one that would would be not nearly as sensitive to the cost, because essentially you'd only be trying to make one at a time, and it would be a research project. But it would be much more sensitive to the completeness of the self-replicating capability. Right now with the RepRap, it can only make about half of its own parts, and you have to go buy the rest at the hardware store. Now the idea is that it makes the expensive parts and you buy the cheap ones, like threaded rods and nuts and bolts and that sort of thing. It can't make stepper motors, which it uses, and it can't make the electronics. As opposed to trying to make the expensive parts and buying the cheap ones, the Feynman path machine would in fact have to make all of the parts that couldn't be made somehow by any other machine. It's a different sort of constraint on the process, and it would wind up producing a machine with a considerably different design. The notion that people ought to be out there studying, working in the field of self-replicating machines and getting a better handle and finding the uses of that technology, I think is fantastic. I wish Adrian the best of luck.
Yeah.
All right. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're going an additional 15 minutes this evening talking with Jay Storrs Hall. It was just too interesting. We couldn't let him go, so he's graciously decided to stay on with us, so we could get into our favorite topic. But before we go there, I just want to ask one question about this idea of replicating machines, making themselves, making smaller copies of themselves, working their way down on that path that Feynman described. Does anyone have a bead on how many generations it takes from the kinds of machines we have now to get, if you just work your way down, to get to a nano, you know, molecularly precise assembler, or is that too fantastical of a question to ask at this point?
I've written analyses that estimate sort of 6 or 7 generations, but it depends a lot on where you start. And so before you really start in on the project, and the first thing that we're going to be doing is just a lot of studying and trying to figure out exactly how small you can make that very first one using existing technology. The key is not really the size of the machine, it's the precision with which it can make the stuff that it makes.
Right.
Because when you reach atomic precision, no matter how big the piece is, you're at the point where nanotechnology starts kicking in.
That's an excellent point. So the machines themselves could actually
get bigger, but right now the typical ratio of the size of a part to its precision is about 10,000 to 1. If you have a part that whose size is on the order of an inch, and the precision with which the surfaces that matter, you know, the ones that bear on other parts and so forth, are on the order of a 1/10 of an inch for you know, very, very fine, high quality machining. If you can retain that ratio, you're at atomic precision when your part is 10,000 atoms across.
Right. So 5 or 6 generations, that doesn't sound that far off. Okay, so we've got to move on to our to our next topic. I want to start by asking a hypothetical. We started out talking about how the coming technological changes might be like unto the Industrial Revolution, and I have this thought that had there been a Foresight Institute back before the Industrial Revolution, if members of that group tried to put together a picture of what life would be like for people beyond that revolution, what life would be like for us, and they were able to foresee the incredible, by their standards, wealth and opulence that we live in, and the amazing power that we're able to, as individuals, take advantage of between telecommunications and automobiles and aircraft, that to explain to a layperson what was coming, they might say that in the future, your life will be something like that of a wizard king, a metaphor that would give them a glimpse of what life would be like. It's not accurate. We're not wizard kings, but from people back on the other side of that transition, it would look like we are. Now, I've been working on putting together a phrase to describe what life will be like for people on the other side of the changes that we're talking about. And the phrase I've come up with, the one I've been working with, is sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. I think the key technology for us to become sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers is utility fog. So tell us what it is, and tell me if I'm right. Is that the technology that's going to get me there?
Well, let's say utility fog could make you sexy in some ways. It's not going to make you immortal, though. You're going to need real nanomedicine for that.
Yeah, cut to the superpowers, man. That's where I was going.
Okay. All right. Superpowers, yes and no. But a lot closer than what we have now. Basically, imagine the holodeck in the Star Trek, or the Terminator, the liquid metal robot guy, or some of this other stuff that involves smart materials. The simplest way to describe utility fog is it is to three-dimensional matter what a television screen or monitor is to a static picture. That is to say, you can cause things to appear on your monitor screen by changing the colors of pixels, and you can cause things to move by changing the colors of pixels in a moving pattern. With utility fog, you have the stuff that has programmable physical properties. And so if you want objects to appear, you just take the part of the fog where you want the object to appear, and you tell it to change its properties until it has the properties of the object that you want to be there. And if you want the object to disappear, you tell it, okay, change your properties back to the properties of air.
So with a cloud of this kind of fog, and what we're talking about is, I guess, very small airborne, potentially airborne robots, but very, very small robots that are able to take these multitudes of forms. You could have one cloud of fog, which could then become your car, it could become your airplane, it could be your house, it could be your clothes, it could be your pet, right? Anything you could imagine that it was programmed, that it had a software to carry out that program, it could be.
Yeah, there's one thing that is a fairly common misconception. It's not really airborne. The fog itself is actually more like a liquid than a gas.
Oh, okay.
It's actually sort of dense enough. It's about the density of balsa wood. In its sort of standard resting configuration, but it can simulate something like air well enough that you would walk through it and not feel it, that's how there's sort of enough of it there to sort of suddenly simulate an object made of steel or wood or any other common material, what the stuff is actually just literally trillions and trillions of tiny robots, and they're nowhere near as small as atoms, but they do the same kinds of things with respect to each other as atoms do in terms of transmitting force being able to slide or not be able to slide against each other in response to a force, and so forth. And if you get enough of those things programmed, and you get enough of the the robots needing to have a given property to start running the program that tells them to have that property, then you get a pretty decent simulation of macroscopic sized physical objects. The robots themselves would probably be something like roughly the size of a human cell, 10 microns across, maybe as much as 100, but you'd start to be able to feel graininess if that were the case.
So maybe I jumped one ahead, because in fact, if you have enough of this stuff, utility fog could definitely deliver the billionaire experience in the sense that if you have enough utility fog, you could have just about anything that could be described via the software that the utility fog runs. So in terms of...
Right. Well, okay, there's two things here. Before you get to utility fog, or maybe at the same time, or roughly the 2030 time frame, maybe, you're going to be able to get a very, very top-notch virtual reality experience simply by tapping into your brainstem and injecting the signals of all the things that you would be feeling, which is what, Ray Kurzweil talks about that a lot. And you're actually just lying in a bed, and feeling this stuff. And so in terms of a virtual reality experience of being the billionaire, just plain pure VR is going to give you that, at least to that extent. And it's going to be like a video game, only, totally immersive and all that sort of stuff.
Sure, so you get the sexy and the superpowers,
right. Too. Well, the difference with the utility fog is that if you're in enough of a volume of it to do stuff, that you're physically doing this stuff, and if you if you walk out into your backyard and you say, make me 50 feet tall, and you reach down and there's a tree and you grab it and pull it out of the ground, the real tree really comes out of the ground.
Right.
And so that's the difference. But with the utility fog, all of the same sort of stuff that could happen in your virtual reality happens, but it also really happens in the real world.
Okay, so with 30 seconds, do we become utility fog at some point? Do our bodies get made of it? Do we make a leap where we grow up and become clouds of utility or pools of utility fog?
It would be capable of supporting uploading if that's what you wanted to do.
And at that point, I think I really would be a sexy immortal billionaire.
Okay.
Well, you've arrived at that point.
Sorry to keep harping on that, but this is pretty important to me. But in fact, I think that...
That's what I call a retirement.
But Bill Gates will be a quintillionaire, so you'll still be...
Oh, that's okay. I can live with that. I'm fine with that.
Okay.
According to game theory, I'm supposed to have a problem with that, but I really don't at all. As long as I got the billionaire, I think I'm good. Well, Josh, it has been absolutely a pleasure once again having you on the program. We as always, I feel like we just sort of skimmed the surface, and so we hope that we'll be able to have you back on again very soon.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to be here. I enjoyed it a lot, and thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The song is Make a Mistake with Me by John Taglieri.
Boy, that's an offer, huh?
Yeah.
John Taglieri with Make a Mistake with Me. Well, thanks, Stephen, for being part of the program tonight. And Michael, everyone in the chat room, all of you listening live, and everyone who is listening to us in recorded form, thanks for being a part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again next time. And until then, live to see it.
And brittle. Look at this heart, it plays like a fiddle. A bit out of tune, a bit old and dusty. My fingers are calloused, and that's what I must be. You're sitting there, your own little bubble, an empty bottle in your hand, cause life is giving you trouble. When you caught my eye, you and I both knew that here we are. down the life we used to. I just hope that you will let me buy you a drink, sing you a song, you'll sing along, and we can find all the answers to the questions that are deep in us now. Don't even think we can be wrong, just come along and make a mistake with me. Another round, another story. I don't want to hear about the ones that came before me. My time with you, I wouldn't trade a single minute. Yes, we're both a mess, but at least we can admit it. I just hope that you will let me buy you a drink, sing you a song, you'll sing along, and we can find all the answers to the questions that are keeping us down. Don't even think we can be wrong, just come along and make a mistake with me. Sing along and we can find all the answers to the questions that are keeping us down. Don't even think we can be wrong, just come along and make a mistake with me. Make a mistake.